If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
North Highlands, Sacramento.
Good morning. President Trump is hitting the road to sell his efforts to lower prices, even though he calls the affordability issue a hoax. Can he convince voters before the midterm elections? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, a South Bay High School probes a sign of hate formed on its football field. I'm Brian Watt.
Indiana Republicans are answering Trump's call to try and get rid of the state's Democrats in Congress. I'm Layla Faldin.
And Amir Martinez. Trump pressured the state Senate to call a vote on new district maps. Some Republican holdouts have been threatened. Also, Maria Corina Machado, the latest Nobel Peace Prize winner, seems to have given up on peaceful regime change in Venezuela. And is West Texas ready for a black bear resurgence? It's Tuesday, December 9th. On this day in 1965, a Charlie Brown Christmas aired for the first time on CBS. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump will speak in central Pennsylvania tonight about the economy. In a wide-ranging interview published this morning in Politico, Trump insisted that he gives the U.S. economy a huge A+. He says the current economy is one that he inherited from the Biden administration. But the most recent numbers show the inflation rate in September was the same as President Biden's last month in office. The president has changed his position on releasing the video of a second strike on a boat in the Caribbean. That September strike killed two survivors of an initial attack on the boat. The administration claims it was carrying drugs. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben has more.
Last week, Trump told reporters in the Oval Office that he had, quote, no problem with releasing video of the second strike. However, in response to a reporter's question, he denied saying that and said he's deferring to Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth.
Whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with me.
He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Whatever he decides is okay with me.
Trump went on to insult the journalist, calling her obnoxious and a terrible reporter. Hegseth's role in the strikes has come under increasing scrutiny after members of Congress on key committees viewed the video of the second strike behind closed doors last week. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, the White House.
A federal judge says President Trump's executive order blocking new wind energy projects in the U.S. is unlawful. NPR's Giles Snyder says the president signed that order on the first day of his return to the White House.
U.S. District Judge Patty Saris of Massachusetts ruled in favor of a coalition of 17 Democratic-led states in Washington, D.C., calling the executive order arbitrary and capricious. The directive has put the permitting process on hold for the past 11 months. Judge Saris said the indefinite pause violates a statutory requirement that federal agencies conclude work on such matters within a reasonable time.
NPR's Giles Snyder reporting. More than 20 Democratic-led states say they won't give the Trump administration the personal data of people on SNAP food assistance. The administration has threatened to yank funding from states that don't comply. NPR's Jude Joffe Block has more.
The states pointed out a federal judge already issued a preliminary injunction in October, which blocks USDA from withholding funding from states that don't share the data. USDA has asked for items such as SNAP recipients' names, home addresses, birth dates, social security numbers, income information, and immigration status. The states say they object to the federal government collecting Americans' personal data without a clear need for it and cited legal and data security concerns. They suggested sharing de-identified data instead and asked USDA to answer a number of questions, including whether it can confirm state SNAP data won't be used for immigration enforcement. Jude Joffe Block, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. A South Bay high school is investigating after a group of students formed a human swastika on its football field. KQED's Jalar Zeta has more.
San Jose's Branham High School says it received a, quote, disturbing tip about the social media post. The photo, which was reportedly removed 2 days after it went live, showed a group of students forming a, quote, human swastika with their bodies on the football field, and was captioned with an anti-Semitic quote by Adolf Hitler. In a statement, school principal Beth Silbergeld called the incident a, quote, unacceptable act of anti-Semitism, and said the students identified in the photo are, quote, committed to taking accountability for the harm that was done. She said that the incident was reported to San Jose police. I'm Joel Arzeda, KQED News.
State Attorney General Rob Bonta says his office stands ready to assist San Jose officials as they investigate the anti-Semitic incident at Branham High. Bonta says his office will step in to help if asked by local police and school officials.
There's no room for hate in California, no matter who you are, where you're from, who you love, how you pray. You belong here and you deserve to be safe and be able to thrive free of hate.
The attorney general noted that in addition to prosecuting hate crimes, his office compiles a report every year examining the data around such crimes. That information, Bonta says, helps shape policies aimed at countering hate. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Oakland, San Francisco Bay Airport, beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for NPR comes from Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality. And Yarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the listeners of KQED. Now 6:06, here's Clark Reed with KQED traffic.
And a stall, it's southbound Central Freeway, the connector to southbound Van Ness. It's in the right-hand lane. In Kenwood, we have a garbage truck fire eastbound 12 after Adobe Canyon Road. A crew is on the scene, and the eastbound lanes are blocked there. Castro Valley late road work, it's slow. Westbound 580 Heaton Canyon Road to Castro Valley Boulevard. And at the Bay Bridge, metering lights are on. It's backed up at the toll plaza, slow to Fremont Street. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Ahead on KQED News with Brian Watt at 6:22, one of the medical treatments gaining traction here in the Bay Area involves ketamine. Doctors are prescribing it to treat a lot of things, including mental health. But treatment can vary, and the science is still early. What does that mean for patients? More on KQED News coming right up at 6:22 and again later this morning. More fog again today, repeating ourselves. The Bay Area forecast hasn't changed that much. Another day of chilly temperatures for highs, 50s to the mid-60s around the bay. Some areas of dense fog this morning. More sunshine on the way later this morning. Also, another day of widespread dense fog in the Sacramento Valley with cloudy skies. Haze throughout today also. Look for Sacramento Valley highs, 44 to 52.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Culver City, California. President Trump travels to Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania today to talk about his administration's efforts to address a top concern for voters, affordability.
At the White House on Monday, he gave a preview.
You can call it affordability or anything you want, but the Democrats caused the affordability problem, and we're the ones that are fixing it. So it's a very simple statement. They caused it, we're fixing it.
This claim after he previously called affordability a, quote, hoax. In a few moments, we'll unpack the administration's messaging with the Republican strategist. First, let's take a look at Trump's trip, as recent polls show voters blame the president's policies for high prices.
NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith joins us now. Tam, this sort of travel, going out and selling your policies, that's what presidents typically do, except not this year so far.
Yeah, in his second term, President Trump has done very little domestic travel aimed at pitching his policies to the American people. In fact, he's done way more travel to sporting events than going out in the country and making his case. A senior White House official I spoke with, who was not authorized to speak publicly, readily acknowledged that this sort of messaging travel has been lacking and said the president would be ramping it up late this year and into next year, starting with today's trip to Pennsylvania, which is to a competitive congressional district.
I'd rather go to sporting events, too, but that's just me. So what's this first stop message going to be?
Well, the senior White House official I spoke to said that the president will be balancing talking about what they see as real economic good news with an acknowledgement that there's more work to do. And just ask President Biden about the perils of telling people that, well, actually, the economy is fine when their cost of living is way up. Getting the tone right on the economy is something presidents have often struggled with. Trump himself has been a bit off message. Take this from a cabinet meeting last week.
The word affordability is a con job by the Democrats. They say affordable. I watched the other day where some very low IQ congresswoman talked about affordability. She had no idea. Their prices were much higher.
And inflation did get alarmingly high under Biden, but then it slowed down. The most recent inflation numbers show that the rate in September was the same as it was during Biden's last month in office.
Okay, then will Trump's messaging be paired with any new policies that could actually bring prices down?
It's a good question, and I'd say that you can never be certain what Trump will say until he says it. But in recent weeks, we've seen a lot of officials all the way up to the vice president asking for patience, saying it will take time for the president's policies to hit the economy. White House economist Kevin Hassett was on CNBC yesterday and said people with income from tips and overtime should get tax refunds next year.
That kind of stuff is going to make it so that people are going to look at their wallets and say, oh, boy, this guy's really making me better off. And in the end, that's more important than any poll.
But the polls are a problem. Trying to turn that around before the midterms is part of what Trump's doing out on the road today. And yesterday, the president announced a $12 billion bailout for farmers who've been hurt by his tariffs. The administration is casting this as bridge money until the president's trade deals pay off. But it's also an acknowledgement that there are real economic pain points.
All right, that's NPR's Tamara Keith. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Donald Trump made rising costs a central theme of his 2024 presidential campaign. Here he is during a campaign rally last year.
Under Kamala Harris and crooked Joe Biden, the American dream is dead. You don't hear about the American dream anymore. It's dead. Her radical liberal policies have caused horrific inflation, decimated the middle class, and gutted the finances of millions and millions of American families.
But 11 months into Trump's second term, consumer prices are rising, and he's trying to distance himself from the problem.
Just about everything is down. You know, this whole thing is, they use the word affordability. It's a Democrat hoax. They're the ones that drove the prices up.
How's that message playing with voters, and could it be a problem for Republicans in the midterms? Let's talk about it with Republican strategist Brendan Buck. He's a partner in the consulting firm Seven Letter and previously worked as a staffer for two former House speakers, Paul Ryan and John Boehner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so the president campaigned on affordability. Then from the White House, he's calling it a Democratic hoax, but at the same time blaming higher prices on Democrats. How is that going to play with voters?
Yeah, messaging on the economy is always hard because you're confronting people's experiences every day and trying to, especially when you're trying to tell them something that is different than what they feel. So it takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of discipline. I think the challenge for this White House is that this is a president who seems very not bought into this idea that it is even a problem. And they can send him to Pennsylvania and they can put the right talking points in the teleprompter. But if he doesn't actually believe it, I think it's going to be hard for them to continue to make a difference on people, how people feel about it. All it takes is one or two more lines like that, that this is a hoax or a con job, and Democrats are going to be able to take this issue away from him. And as you said, it's the issue that he won the election on.
So you mentioned Pennsylvania. He's expected to talk about high costs at a rally later today. What should he tell Americans? I mean, you're saying he doesn't even believe there is an affordability issue.
Well, one of the things that Donald Trump was always very good at, and polls showed this, is that he was better than most Republicans at empathy. Mm. People felt like he was actually fighting for them. And that was an issue where polls showed that Donald Trump cared more about people than the Democratic Party. And that's something that Republicans had always struggled with. And that was an advantage that he took. And now I think he's squandering that away. It certainly doesn't feel empathetic when he's telling people that that their issue is a con job. At the same time, people don't see him focusing on this issue every day. You know, they're talking about a few of these economic issues now, but most of this administration has been spent focusing on foreign policy issues, or even some trivial issues. And people look up and see him working on the a ballroom or hosting Kennedy Center honors, and that doesn't project a message that you are laser focused on the thing that they care about. So they need to talk about it. They need to put policies in place. I would start with the tariffs. Getting rid of those would be, I think, a huge start. But I'm not holding my breath that he's going to give up on what he considers one of his signature policy achievements.
Is this president making the same mistake as President Biden, trying to convince Americans that affordability, that what they're feeling is not really what they're feeling? The economy is good. Affordability isn't an issue.
Clearly, and we've seen what happens with Vertz when you do that. Voters will take it out on the party in power. I mean, I think every party suffers from this a little bit, where you get elected and you think that you were elected based on everybody loving all of your ideas, when in reality it was really more likely just a rejection of the previous administration and what they did. Voters will take it out on you if you do not make their lives feel better. And right now, it's very clear that the president has squandered his polling on the economy. And it would be one thing if there really was a bright light at the end of the tunnel here, if there was something coming next year that we could reliably think is going to make people feel better. I'm just not convinced that the one big beautiful bill, the tax act they did this past year, is actually going to change people's feelings going into next year. So, yeah, it's a huge problem.
So is this a lane that the Democrats now own politically, messaging-wise, with voters because they're not in power? We saw that work really well in elections this year for Democrats like New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani's race.
Yeah, and it's as simple as you said, just not being in power. I mean, sometimes we overthink these things that Democrats need a 10-point plan of how they're going to lower inflation. I think that is good to have if they have it. But as a matter of pure politics, simply being the out party and the party out of power and saying that the people in charge aren't getting it done is really powerful. That's what happened with Joe Biden. He was in charge. It was on his watch. Didn't solve the problem. And Donald Trump will probably meet the same fate in the midterms if he faces the same situation. You've been in charge for a year or 2 years by the time the midterm terms comes around, and you haven't solved the problem. It's as simple as that. And people will swing to the other party unless they feel like you are addressing their core concerns.
Brendan Buck is a Republican strategist with the firm Seven Letter. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
After weeks of speculation, Representative Jasmine Crockett officially launched her U.S. Senate campaign in Dallas yesterday. Crockett has garnered national attention for her outspoken criticism of President Trump, and now she's aiming to do something no Texas Democrat has done since 1994, and that's win a statewide election. Becca Moore from member station KERA in Dallas reports.
As Jasmine Crockett told supporters at her campaign announcement in South Dallas Monday night, her gloves have been off, but now she's jumping into the ring.
Because Texas, this moment we're in now, is life or death. It's all or nothing. It's now or never.
Texas Democrats know that unseating the incumbent Republican John Cornyn won't be easy, but think their best chance is with a more polarizing candidate, like Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. He's running against Cornyn in the GOP primary. Paxton is a Trump loyalist with a controversial background. Democratic organizers hope that makes him vulnerable given recent trends and a candidate Crockett could beat. In last month's election, voters showed strong support for Democratic candidates in typically Republican strongholds, and Crockett's hoping to capitalize on that shift.
My message, rooted in slashing costs, making homeownership and entrepreneurship attainable for all, strengthening and growing the middle class, is one that Texas, all of Texas, from the Panhandle to Port Arthur and from El Paso to East Texas, can believe in.
And polling shows Crockett may have the best chance of all the Democratic hopefuls. In a recent survey from the University of Houston's Hobby School of Public Affairs, she received the majority support of likely voters in a hypothetical contest against Texas State Representative James Tallarico and former Congressman Colin Allred. She'll only face Tallarico in the primaries, though. Allred dropped out to avoid a runoff and to maximize the chance of Democrats flipping the seat. But doing so in a reliably red state will be an uphill battle. Crockett urged her supporters not to let that deter them.
For most of us, a Republican-controlled Texas is all we've known. But we cannot let that diminish our faith and belief in what can be.
If Crockett is successful in her Senate bid, she'll be the first Black woman to ever win a statewide election in Texas. For NPR News, I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
This is NPR News.
And from San Francisco, it's KQED, covering Northern California and beyond. I'm Dave Freeman at 619 on this Tuesday morning. KQED News, covered by Brian Watt. Join us for that at 622. And in about 31 minutes, the California Report with Marty Bolaños. Now over to Clark Reed. He has a look at the morning traffic.
In San Francisco, an accident. Southbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. Number 2 lane is blocked. Also cars at the shoulder. It's jammed from the 80-101 split now. Castro Valley, an accident. Westbound 580 Eden Canyon Road. 2 cars at the center divide. It's heavy on westbound 580 from Castro Valley Boulevard to 238 due to late road work going on there. And in Kenwood, a garbage truck blocking the eastbound lane of Highway 12 after Adobe Canyon Road. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting The Perfect Neighbor, a documentary by Gita Gandaber. Body cam footage bears witness to a tight-knit community navigating one neighbor's relentless harassment and the consequences of Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. Awards eligible. Cal Privacy, enforcing privacy regulations and protecting consumer rights. Californians can take control of their personal information by opting out of selling and sharing it with businesses. More information at privacy.ca.gov.
If you're planning a trip to a national park next year, get ready for some big changes. The Trump administration is dropping free entry on civil rights holidays like MLK Day and Juneteenth, and adding President Trump's birthday instead. Plus, international visitors will face higher fees and new ID checks. I'm Adi Bolaños. We'll walk you through what's changing and why it matters on the next California Report.
Coming up in 30 minutes, Forum later at 9, talking about the role of mobile homes in providing affordable housing. Join us for Forum 9 to 11 today, rebroadcast later this evening, if you wish, 8 to 10. Support for NPR This Morning comes from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And the listeners and members of KQED. Now 622.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. A major BART expansion is underway in Santa Clara County, where crews are preparing to dig a massive tunnel underneath San Jose. KQED's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman went to the construction site yesterday and has this report.
Just blocks away from San Jose Mineta International Airport is a site the VTA is calling the West Portal.
Follow those folks for me, please. I appreciate it. Watch your footing.
This dirt lot is about a mile long, and it's full of cranes, trucks, and crews. All the work right now is focused on preparing a steep concrete ramp for the arrival of a tunnel boring machine. Sarah Wilson is the construction director for BART Silicon Valley Phase 2.
It's really cool. It's huge. It's state-of-the-art. Like, it's going to be so much fun.
The project will add 6 new miles of BART track, 4 new stations, and connect with the existing BART system at Berryessa Station. Most of that track will be located under San Jose.
We can see progress, and we have momentum, and we need to keep that momentum going.
Tom McGuire is with the VTA, which is building the expansion. The project was originally slated to finish by next year at a cost of $4.7 billion, but it's faced heavy delays and cost overruns. It's now expected to cost nearly 3 times that and take more than 10 years longer. Sudhanshu Jain is a Santa Clara City Council member and a member of the BART Oversight Committee for this project.
Oh, it's transformational because, you know, we are already have massive traffic congestion.
When it's completed, the expansion will connect with Caltrain in Santa Clara, creating a ring of electrified rail transit around the San Francisco Bay. I'm Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman, KQED News.
A growing number of people in the Bay Area are turning to ketamine for relief from depression, anxiety, even chronic pain. But treatment can differ wildly from one provider to the next. KQED health correspondent Leslie McClurg reports, and here's a note, this story contains a mention of sexual abuse.
On a cozy gray couch, Aaliyah Economos settles in across from her therapist. She takes a few deep breaths Then she lifts a ketamine nasal spray to her nose. Soon, visions begin to flood her mind.
The Black Widow, the devil, Medusa, the fire-breathing dragon, evil itself.
What begins as dissociated images transforms into flashbacks from her childhood that eventually clarify into
a very vivid memory of being sexually abused.
She had forgotten it all until she tried ketamine-assisted therapy.
I did not have the capacity to feel into the depth and the pain of what my body was holding back without it.
Economos is 51. She's very put together. But for most of her life, the mother of three felt flat inside. She cycled through antidepressants. And then about 6 years ago, her mental health collapsed.
My body really just shut down entirely on me. I couldn't get out of bed. And
did something happen?
No, nothing happened.
She couldn't work. She saw doctor after doctor, but every test came back normal. She saw a trauma specialist, tried naturopaths, elimination diets. At one time, she was taking
like 38 pills a day.
Nothing helped until she tried ketamine. Historically, the drug has lived in very different worlds. In hospitals, doctors use it as a safe and reliable anesthetic. In clubs, partiers illegally take it to feel a sense of euphoria. In recent years, psychiatrists have prescribed it for treatment-resistant depression. Basically, it disrupts how brain cells normally talk to each other. Gerard Santacora is a professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine.
Shortly after giving a dose of ketamine, there's an increase in the brain's ability to form new connections that could be sustained.
Studies show it can snap people out of suicidal spirals.
It really is a potentially life-saving drug for many people.
The FDA approved esketamine in 2019, a chemical cousin of ketamine. Because it's covered by insurance, Jennifer Siegel signed up for 10 sessions at an Oakland clinic. The 57-year-old was in a tough place.
It started with my brother's suicide.
Then her father died.
And I was going through divorce.
By then, her antidepressant had been paired with an antipsychotic to boost its effect, but
they weren't strong enough anymore, which is what led to the ketamine.
She walked into a bare treatment room, just a recliner, box of tissues, a jar of Jolly Ranchers. When the session started, the nasal spray slid down her throat, numbing her mouth and sending her into a wave of panic. The psychiatrist stayed mostly silent, even as Siegel began to cry.
That he was just there to make sure I didn't die, basically, is how I felt.
The experience was so off-putting that she canceled the series. Instead, she paid out of pocket for a clinic with a much warmer approach.
It's exactly what I had been looking for.
When ketamine is prescribed off-label, the dose, the number of infusions, aftercare instructions can all differ, even from clinics within the same city. Smita Das is an addiction psychiatrist at Stanford Medicine.
There's more and more of these clinics that are popping up that are touting ketamine as a treatment for depression, PTSD, OCD, and more without it actually being currently in practice guidelines.
And is there any research showing that it can work for these things?
Yeah, there's certainly promising studies. However, just because there is a study of, you know, a small handful of people, we still don't know how effective that medication is in the long term.
So why are doctors prescribing it for so many things, and how can they? Think of it like Botox, which the FDA cleared for eye spasms, but doctors have expanded its use for migraines, jaw pain, dozens of other conditions. The same is true for ketamine. It's cleared as an anesthetic, but being used to treat much more. And that can serve patients like Aaliyah Economos. She says she's never felt better.
The body aches are completely gone.
She's off antidepressants, her energy's back, and she credits ketamine. But with treatment that varies from clinic to clinic, and the science still early, patients are left to decide if it's worth the risk. I'm Leslie McClurg, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Checking in again with Clark Reed. Traffic in San Francisco now at 6:29.
An accident southbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. It's in the number 2 lane and another vehicle at the shoulder. Things are jammed up from the 80-101 split. A garbage truck on fire in Kenwood. Eastbound 12 after Adobe Canyon Road. A crew on the scene. Eastbound lanes are blocked. Heavy fog reported there, too. And in Castro Valley, an accident westbound 580 Eden Canyon Road. A couple of cars there at the Center Divide. Bay Bridge backed up to West Grand. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support also comes from PG&E, reminding customers to act quickly if they smell gas in their homes or business. Get outside, travel a safe distance away, and dial 911. First responders will make it safe. Learn more at pge.com/safety. Areas of dense fog this morning, partly cloudy skies, some sunshine later today, still chilly, highs around the bay, 50s to the mid-60s, 6:30.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump says his administration plans to spend $12 billion to help farmers in the U.S. hurt by the trade war and tariffs. As NPR's Anusha Mather reports, farmers are to receive one-time payments.
The American agriculture industry is deeply intertwined with federal policy. Most of the government support that U.S. farmers receive is outlined in the Farm Bill. The most recent bill passed in 2018 under the first Trump administration. Vanessa Garcia Polanco from the National Young Farmers Coalition says at this point it's outdated, but she hopes for a new one next year.
There is still strong appetite to build those bridges between farmers and consumers in a bipartisan way.
The current bill is in place through next September. Lawmakers from both parties have been pushing for a new bill for years. Trump administration officials say that further agricultural reform is an administration priority for 2026. Anusha Mather, NPR News.
Even as he acknowledges American farmers need financial help because of his trade war, the president is giving himself high marks on his handling of the U.S. economy. In an interview with Politico, Trump graded himself with an A++++++. He'll be traveling to Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania later today to discuss affordability and the cost of living. This is NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. Closing arguments are expected to wrap up today in the murder trial of San Francisco filmmaker Kevin Epps. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports.
On Monday, Epps' defense team tried to chip away at prosecutors' portrayal of Marcus Polk, Epps' ex-brother-in-law, as an affable, if troubled family member who routinely visited to hang out, watch TV, and even help out. Prosecutors told jurors that Epps shot Polk out of irritation during one of these visits at the home of Epps' then-fiancé and their children. But Epps' lawyers argued that Polk was an unwelcome intruder with a meth habit who refused to leave when Epps asked him to. They said Polk threatened to beat up maintenance workers outside and later came at Epps, who shot him in self-defense. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
The Trump administration yesterday denied Endangered Species Act protection to Western Coast Chinook salmon in Northern California. Administration officials wrote that based on the best available scientific evidence, after a review, the species does not require additional protection. Environmental groups say the spring-run Chinook salmon are in significant decline. Jeff Miller is with the Center for Biological Diversity.
I mean, this isn't going to just harm these salmon. It's going to harm all the other wildlife that depends on them. Orcas almost preferentially feed on these spring-run Chinook.
Miller says the group is seeking ways to appeal the federal decision and ways California itself can protect the fish. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Morning support comes from San Francisco Bay University with degrees in tech and business for an AI-driven economy, sfbu.edu. Support for KQED comes from Earth Justice, the nation's largest environmental law organization with more than 200 full-time lawyers who fight for a healthy environment. Learn more about how to get involved at earthjustice.org, Earth Justice because the Earth needs a good lawyer. The San Francisco Symphony presenting holiday family films on the big screen as the San Francisco Symphony performs the scores live. Learn more about their holiday programs at sfsymphony.org/holiday. This week in KQED Arts, it was a tough year for Bay Area Theater, but it still produced a lot of standout moments. Joan Baez and the Circus, and Hamlet Reimagined with Barbecue. That's at kqed.org/arts. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. Capital One with a Capital One Quicksilver card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And by the sustaining members of KQED. Sacramento Valley, cloudy, widespread morning, fog, dense in some parts of the valley, and haze later today. Highs 44 to 52, Sacramento Valley. I'm Dave Freeman at 635.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Sammy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Now to Indiana, where the state Senate is convening in a special session this week. Senators plan to vote on new political maps that would help Republicans capture all 9 of Indiana's seats in Congress.
It's the latest in an unprecedented wave of mid-cycle redistricting spurred by President Trump's demands to boost his party's chances in next year's midterms.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass joins us now from Indianapolis. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Leila.
So lots of states, right, are doing this mid-cycle redistricting in this kind of tit-for-tat. Why is Indiana so notable?
Well, first, it is high drama. We do not know what's going to happen here. Currently, Indiana is represented by 7 Republicans and 2 Democrats. The proposed map would dismantle those 2 heavily Democratic districts. Even many Republican lawmakers have pushed back despite a lot of pressure from Trump and his allies. So if this effort fails, it's a huge rebuke. And if it passes, Democrats could be wiped out from Indiana's delegation.
So a lot at stake here. You're there in Indianapolis. What are you seeing at the state capitol?
Hundreds of protesters with handmade signs packed the hall outside the Senate yesterday. The protesters opposed to redistricting were chanting so loudly that senators could hear it inside the chamber. 127 people signed up for public comment. I met one of them, Leon Bates.
Franklin said, democracy is a wonderful thing if you can keep it. And here we are. We may be watching it slip away right before our eyes.
Bates told me his predominantly black community will be chopped up. The new map will divide Indianapolis into 4, so a voter in the city could soon be in a district that stretches 150 miles to Kentucky.
Wow. So remind us why this redistricting push is happening now.
Normally, new maps are drawn after a census, but Trump has pushed Republican-run states to redraw before the midterms. Voter Gregory Cantor told lawmakers that Republicans have to do what they can to keep the House.
It's a choice between the president your voters elected, 60 to 40, having a full term, or being a lame duck fighting endless nonsense impeachments and investigations.
So now some Democratic-controlled states are trying to redistrict, too.
Now, Republicans control Indiana's legislature, so why is passing this new map not a sure thing?
A lot of Republicans have heard from constituents that they do not want this. The top Senate Republican initially rebuffed holding a session, saying the votes just weren't there. But Trump amped up the pressure, even calling out undecided members by name. Some Republican senators, like Greg Walker, faced threats of violence. Last night, he said relenting in his opposition would have been like accepting a bribe, and said the stakes really crystallized for him recently as he held a constituent's baby.
As I thought about the future for that child, where we accept that intimidation is normal, and I shall refuse the offer for the sake of that child and the future of the state.
You can really hear the emotion in his voice. Does it seem like this new map will become law?
The map already passed the House and advanced out of a Senate committee last night, but the Indiana Senate Majority Leader told us we're all going to find out what will happen when the Senate votes later this week.
NPR congressional reporter Sam Greenglass in Indianapolis. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Leila.
Black bears are making a comeback in far west Texas. Now, they used to be the biggest predator there, but overhunting led to their decline. For decades, there were so few black bears that it was illegal to kill them in Texas. But conservation efforts paid off, and now they're getting spotted in rural towns and cities. So are Texans ready to welcome the bears back? Here's Carlos Morales.
In one of the most remote corners of Texas, Matt Hewitt is unlocking the door to a giant steel trap he's hoping will catch a bear.
Yeah, it's completely empty.
Hewitt is with the Borderlands Research Institute in Alpine, Texas.
And I'm trying to look at population abundance, so trying to figure out how many bears are out here.
The 8-foot-long trap is made of steel. On one end, there's a sliding door, and inside is a dangling plastic jug. Hewitt fills it with bait, stale, days-old glazed donuts and frozen cantaloupe.
All right, that'll catch a bear.
The number of black bears in West Texas has been on the rise. Sightings in the state have jumped from nearly 80 in 2020 to just over 130 so far this year. But Hewitt says in West Texas, an exact population count is still unclear.
But I think it's safe to say there's more than people realize. There's quite a few bears out here.
Black bears have a deep history in the area. Landmarks like canyons and creeks have been named after them, and there's even a bear mascot out here. But for all the celebration, there are challenges and concerns as bears have ventured into neighborhoods, gotten into yards, and have posed a threat to livestock, too.
I don't mind the bears coming back. We don't want them wiped out, that's for sure. You know, they were almost extinct.
That's Pam Klaus. She grew up in Alpine and considers herself a wildlife enthusiast.
I just don't think that they belong on our property.
Klaus says her and her husband used to sprinkle food and keep troughs of water on their property for wildlife, like roaming deer and javelina. They've since removed all of that at the suggestion of state officials, and they even electrified their fence. But the bears are still coming around.
These bears are pretty large. They're probably 400 or 500 pounds, if I had to guess.
In places like Montana and Colorado, they've adapted to living with bears by installing bear-resistant dumpsters and trash bins, and in some cases, even installing alarm systems or sprinklers, things to try to startle bears so they leave. But really, the most important measure, removing food.
They have great sense of smell, much better than our own, so number one, they can smell food when you and I would never have a clue.
That's Raymond Skiles. He's the former wildlife biologist at Big Bend National Park. Skiles says it took time and work at the park, but they were able to adapt to the return of bears there. But can that happen in cities and towns across West Texas?
That's a great question, you know. Will people adapt to bears and their environment here in West Texas?
From the mountainous reaches of the national park, an area dotted with prickly pears and yuccas, the bears are now pushing north. Wildlife experts say it's likely because the land there has reached what they call carrying capacity.
And when you're over carrying capacity, there's not the resources on the natural landscape for those animals.
Krista Demery is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department.
So then they begin to move out and search for new food sources.
Demery's job is making sure people across West Texas are ready to live with bears, something they haven't experienced in decades.
And that's a long time. That means there's not a generation alive really today that has had to live with black bear before.
But the next generation in Alpine, and the ones after that, will likely grow up knowing this place, once again, as bear country. For NPR News, I'm Carlos Morales in Alpine, Texas.
Look for the bear necessities, the simple bear necessities. Forget about your...
This is NPR News.
Clark Reed takes a look at your Bay Area traffic now, starting again in San Francisco.
An accident southbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. Number 2 lane is blocked. It's a jam from the 80-101 split and now backing up on the westbound Skyway. In the Santa Cruz Mountains, a stalled bus northbound 17 Old Santa Cruz Highway. It's in the right lane and we still have a garbage truck fire in Kenwood, eastbound 12 after Adobe Canyon Road. Eastbound lanes are blocked there. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support for Clark comes to us from Rush Creek Lodge and Spot Yosemite. I'm Dave Freeman at 6:43. Your KQED perspective is next. John Levine shares his experience with wild turkeys and what makes them interesting birds.
Traffic slowed, then suddenly stopped. I was on my way home from running errands, and though I was not in a huge hurry, I found myself tensing up. I got out of my car to see what the holdup was. A flock of wild turkeys, 5 to be exact, was leisurely crossing the street. But they weren't moving very fast. In fact, they just seemed to be walking to and fro, oblivious to the cars that had stopped to avoid hitting them. I was impressed that my fellow motorists were willing to take a few minutes out of their busy day to allow these birds to find their way across the street. I was reminded of other instances when I found my schedule interrupted by wildlife crossing, waiting for sheep to traverse a rural road in New Zealand, watching a herd of cattle meander across a byway in Nigeria. I was on vacation then, so I wasn't as concerned about getting somewhere. I saw the animals as more of a spectacle and less of an inconvenience. Recently, there have been stories of people intimidated by the proliferation of turkeys. Some birds have been reportedly acting aggressively. There are more than a few stories about birds pecking car doors, supposedly part of a mating ritual, mistaking the reflection for a rival turkey. There's a myth that Benjamin Franklin lobbied for the wild turkey as the American symbol over the bald eagle. He considered the turkey a much more respectable bird than the eagle. Today, due to conservation efforts that began in the 1970s, wild turkeys inhabit 49 of the 50 states, Alaska being the exception. There, bald eagles are abundant, and Alaskans' attitudes towards eagles range from respect to disgust. Just as Californians might see our wild turkeys as pests, so Alaskans look at eagles. As we move into the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, perhaps we can extend our wishes of goodwill beyond people to nature, including turkeys. With the perspective, I'm John Levine.
John Levine is a writer, teacher, and fledgling birder. He lives in Berkeley. Support for Perspectives comes from Liefke Brazier, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over five decades. Online at lchb.com. Next for you, the federal HIPAA law protects patient privacy, but some say it can shut out family members trying to help relatives who are experiencing mental health crisis. The story ahead on KQED News from Morning Edition, NPR, and the California Report with Mati Bolaños ahead on this Tuesday morning. Get all the latest statewide coverage coming right up at 6:51 a.m. here on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor, can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Good morning. A visit to a doctor's office often means patients have to sign a HIPAA form. The Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act limits when medical information can be shared. But some advocates say those protections can also get in the way of care. Maxwell Howard from member station Interlochen Public Radio brings us the story of a mother and son in Michigan.
Lori is 74 and retired, but when her son Stephen was diagnosed with a schizoaffective disorder a few years ago, she became his sole caretaker. We're only using first names here to protect Stephen's medical privacy.
One of the things that he does when he goes really manic or psychotic or whatever it is he starts emptying things. And so he started taking all of the antiques out into the front yard. That was the first time he was hospitalized.
Because Stephen is in his 40s, Lori is often excluded from his emergency care at different hospitals. She's now pursuing temporary medical guardianship so providers can speak with her directly. But for now, she says, HIPAA still makes it difficult to help.
He came out of the hospital once with extreme diarrhea, extreme thirst, and he said his heart hurt, which if you look at some of those medications is a side effect. When I call, they won't talk to me. They won't tell me what he's been on.
Lori says she's repeatedly asked staff at Munson Medical Center in Traverse City to notify her when her son was released, but they often discharged him without notice, including once on a cold winter night in his pajamas and slippers.
He walked home. I hope he didn't have frostbite. I don't know.
Munson declined to comment on individual cases. Dr. Charles DK is a professor of psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine.
It's a very difficult, challenging situation.
He says HIPAA is important especially to these kinds of patients due to stigma around mental health.
It's easier to tell people that, you know, I fractured my humerus, I fractured my thigh, and I was in the hospital for that. It's much more difficult to tell people that I had a mental break. And so the protections that HIPAA has is to allow individuals to take control of what they disclose related to their mental health.
Still, Dr. DK says it's important to keep families informed, especially when patients live at home.
You're balancing the rights of that individual with the rights of the society to be free of harm.
Critics say it's necessary to change the law. They call the restrictions HIPAA handcuffs. Nearly a decade ago, a congressional effort to eliminate those restrictions fell flat. And since then, recent efforts by grassroots groups petitioning for reform have not been successful. Jerry Clark is an executive at the Treatment Advocacy Center, a Virginia-based nonprofit which advocates for people with severe mental illness. She says the fear of violating HIPAA makes many providers overly cautious because violations can result in fines up to $1.5 million a year, criminal charges, and even jail time. However, she says, that caution can come at patient expense, and there's no reason to exclude caregivers.
I think there's been a lot of misinformation about HIPAA and poor training around HIPAA. So it's easier for providers to say, I can't talk to you.
Clark says that better provider training and a shift away from fear-based HIPAA interpretations could help families stay informed without sacrificing privacy. But until that happens, many caregivers will be left to navigate mental health crises in the dark, trying to keep their loved ones safe without all the information needed. For NPR News, I'm Maxwell Howard in Traverse City.
This is NPR News.
Clark rechecking in again. Another look at traffic starting again in San Francisco.
An accident on southbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. The number two lane is still blocked. It's jammed up from the 80-101 split and also backing up on the westbound Skyway. But better news, freeway service patrol now at the scene. They should get that cleared up in a bit. In the Santa Cruz Mountains, a stalled bus, northbound 17 Old Santa Cruz Highway, right lane is blocked there, and still have a garbage truck fire with a crew at the scene. Eastbound 12 after Adobe Canyon Road in Kenwood. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes to us on Tuesday from Shenyun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from San Francisco Baykeeper, combining boat and drone investigations with science-based advocacy and litigation. Baykeeper works to hold polluters accountable to protect the health of the Bay and Bay Area communities. Learn more at baykeeper.org. VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. The time now, 6:51.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Adi Bolaños in San Francisco. UC Merced is celebrating the largest philanthropic gift in its history. Mackenzie Scott is giving the campus $38 million, an investment meant to expand access, opportunity, and research in the Central Valley. University leaders say the funding will boost student success programs for low-income students, strengthen faculty research, and help build new spaces for teaching and discovery. And it comes just days after she donated $50 million to Cal State East Bay. The Ukrainian wife of a U.S. citizen remains in ICE custody after she was detained late last week in San Diego. As KPBS's Corey Suzuki reports, her lawyers say the arrest marks another new escalation in the Trump administration's emerging practice of targeting immigrants at their green card interviews.
Victoria Bulavina had just finished the final interview in her green card application when the officer asking questions said she needed to step out of the room. A moment later, the officer came back. Behind her were two federal agents. They handcuffed Bulavina and took her away. That's according to Bulavina's husband, Victor Carroll, who was also there.
What she's going through right now is not necessary. I think it's a politics playing out in an ugly way.
In recent weeks, immigration lawyers say federal agents have been targeting dozens of immigrants coming in for green card interviews in San Diego, in many cases over small visa violations. But Bulavina's attorneys say her case is even more extreme because she always has had legal status. Caroline Matthews is with Pathways to Citizenship, a nonprofit in San Diego.
The law seems to change almost daily, and that no one should want that. We should all want to know, what are the rules? What are the laws, and how do I adhere to them?
Carroll is focused on holding things together for their family. He's organized a letter-writing campaign and reached out to members of Congress to plead for Bulavina's release. ICE did not respond to questions. For the California Report, I'm Corey Suzuki in San Diego.
Californians hoping to take advantage of free entry days at national parks will see big changes next year. The Trump administration is removing civil rights holidays and adding President Trump's birthday instead. The move is already prompting backlash from civil rights groups and conservation advocates. International visitors will also face new rules for park access. So to walk us through what's changing, I'm joined by KQED's outdoors engagement reporter, Sarah Wright. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what exactly is the National Park Service changing about free entry days?
So starting next year, they have revised the calendar of fee-free entry days to national parks, removing Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Juneteenth, other days like the National Public Lands Day, and the anniversary of the Great American Outdoors Act. And in replacement, the National Park Service and Department of Interior have added President Donald Trump's birthday, which is also Flag Day on June 14th. They're also adding the 110th anniversary of the NPS in August, Constitution Day in September, and Teddy Roosevelt's birthday in October, calling those days patriotic fee-free days. In addition, Veterans Day, Memorial Day, the 4th of July, and President's Day will all be fee-free as well.
And what are you hearing from park advocates and lawmakers about the impact that this will have?
So not only are they pushing back against removing MLK Day and Juneteenth in particular, calling the move racist because both of those days honor Black history, MLK Day in particular is typically a volunteer day of action at our local parks here in California. So they're concerned that all of the work that happens early on in the year during that day will not.
Yes. In fact, we spoke with Kristen Brengel with the National Parks Conservancy Association. She worries fewer people will volunteer now that it won't be free anymore.
What a great message it sends to park visitors to come and do community service in parks and not have to pay an entrance fee. So this has been a longstanding fee-free day because it's also a day of service. So this doesn't make any sense to us why they removed it. And we're also concerned about taking Juneteenth off the fee-free days because it recognizes an important day in African-American history in our country. And this seems to be symptomatic of other things the administration is doing to sort of sanitize Black history in our country.
How will international visitors be affected by these new policies?
So another huge change in the works for next year is a $100 per person fee will be imposed for international travelers entering parks. And that fee is per person. So when you get to the gate and you're entering, usually there's around a $35 vehicle fee. Now anybody in the car who can't prove that they're a U.S. resident will have to pay an additional $100. There will also be ID checks to confirm this at national park entrances. And the annual pass, that's typically $80 for residents. There will be an option for non-residents that's $250 now.
Wow, that is expensive. Do these new policies go into effect January 1st?
Yes. So if you buy a pass after January 1st or try to enter a park after January 1st, you'll be facing these new structures, these new fee-free days. That said, anybody who did already purchase their annual America the Beautiful pass, they kind of operate on a rolling basis. Those passes will still be honored under the old rules.
Okay. And what kind of impact will these changes have on parks and the staff?
So I spoke to some business owners of tourism agencies around Yosemite National Park here in California, and they're particularly worried about this fee on international travel. They're worried it could deter travelers. And these folks who operate tours around the park are also just worried about what this is going to do to the role of the park ranger who collects fees at park entrances, who will now be asked to sort of determine U.S. residency on the fly, checking IDs not just to confirm they are who they say they are, but also for their residency status.
That was KQED's outdoor engagement reporter, Sarah Wright. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Maddie.
Support for the California Report comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at more than 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
And that is the California Report for Tuesday, December 9th. We're a production of KQED News. I'm Abby Bolaños. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
KQED News Morning Edition will continue in a minute. Now we'd like to direct your attention over to Clark Reed for another look at your commute.
In San Francisco, an accident. Southbound 101 before Cesar Chavez. Everything off to the shoulder now, but it's jammed from the 80-101 split and backing up on the westbound Skyway. They do have tow trucks on the way now. Pleasanton, an accident. Eastbound 580 before Foothill San Ramon. It's over to the side, but things there stop and go from Eden Canyon Road. And a wreck in Novato on southbound 101 after 37. It's got things crawling from Roland. Backed up to the maze now at the Bay Bridge. Clark Reed for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Glime, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from Good Earth Natural Foods, serving the Marin community with organic holiday meals, turkeys, and more, with locations in Fairfax and Mill Valley. Now offering curbside pickup and delivery. Learn more at genatural.com.